This week in Retronauts, we go commando up your arsenal. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I believe the number looking at me in the face right here is 378, although, as always, that is subject to change at a whim and the vagaries of time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Parrish. Very vague, very whimsical. Talking about video games this week here on Retronauts. And this episode is a patron request, once again coming from our friend and supporter, Bill Nielsen. Bill, what's up?
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for having me back. And I would make a butt-based pun here, but I think it'd be beneath me.
But fortunately for terrible puns and things offensive humor, we have someone, we've flown in someone from the UK to make the potty humor for us. Introduce yourself.
Oh, hello. I'm Stuart Jip, and I invested in the Pocket Crotchetizer.
What is the Pocket Crotchetizer?
It's, if you've played Ratchet & Clank 3, it's the thing that the writers think is the funniest thing ever, and it comes up like every other cutscene. It's just some ill-defined, vague device that like does something to your crotch. I don't know what it is.
Oh, so it's not a real thing. You see, it's been a while since I've traveled by airplane, so I was thinking maybe that's like something in the Sharper Image catalog or something.
I mean, to be honest, it probably is SkyMall. I just don't mess with those circles, you know.
Right. All right. Anyway, just to clarify, Bill, Stuart, I was not saying that your jokes are bad. Just that you're not afraid to go blue.
Oh no! Please, Jeremy,
dive into tastelessness.
They're absolutely awful. It's fine.
Okay. Well, as long as we're all on the same page then. But that it does seem appropriate to have us all together because why does it seem appropriate? Well, let's see, because I'm hosting and it was a request from Bill. And I guess because you, Stuart, play a lot of games that have furry characters in them, or mascot type characters.
You nearly made me sound like a bit of a degenerate just
yeah,
then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. So how would you describe your tastes in video games and your attraction to wow, like everything just paints the wrong picture.
There's
here.
No way to make this work.
Okay.
I want to make this clear up front. I've got no problem with furries, and I'm just not attracted to Ratchet or Clank, okay?
Right, no, I'm not.
What about
not
like Talwin or Sasha?
You know what? Let's talk about this later. It's fine. It's not a big deal right now.
Stuart plays a lot of mascot-based games. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I do. This game was right up my street. I was about to say something awful just then. Then I remembered all these games have awful, awful names, so it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell when a game is going to be kind of underwhelming because they don't give it a tawdry name, like Deadlocked. No one liked Deadlocked,
yeah.
And that's because they called it Deadlocked. If they had called it like...
I've taken the liberty of coming up with sexual innuendo names for all the games that don't have them.
What is your ideal name for Deadlocked?
Well, I called it Ratchet & Clank Hot Under the Collar.
Okay, that's not that tawdry.
Well, I originally thought of cuffs and collars, and I was like, is that sexual? I don't know if that's sexual. I don't think it is. But I think Hot Under the Collar is the best I can do, to be honest. I mean, anything else, it would just be a bunch of swearing. You know, I guess maybe like Ratchet and Clank, like Lock Blocked. Would that work?
That's a good... Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right.
But,
you know... I don't want this to be the whole podcast, just like the first hour and a half, and then we can talk about the games, okay?
Right, yeah. So we'll make the dirty jokes up front.
And, yeah.
Let me ask where each of you sort of entered into the series. Like, why, besides my having asked you here, Stuart, why, you know, are you on a Ratchet & Clank podcast? Like, how long have you been playing these games, and what's the appeal for you?
I bought the first one because I went in. I remember this surprisingly vividly. I went into Game, which is the name of our game shop, very creative, to buy Marvel vs. Capcom 2, and it wasn't out. and I had all the money in my hand, so I just bought Ratchet and Clank anyway because I'm an idiot. And turns out it's really good. I really enjoyed it. So basically I just picked up the sequel sort of as they came out sort of secondhand, and the PS2 games, the first four, apart from maybe Deadlocked, I feel like they just kind of get better and better as they go on. I mean, you know, opinions differ on those, but I've always kind of liked it. It's, if anything, it's the PS3 ones where I feel like they start to go off the boil a bit, but we'll get to all that.
And how about you, Bill?
For the longest time, the Ratchet and Clank series was like, oh, wow, they just make a lot of those, don't they? Because I had a GameCube, and then I had a 360, but then I got the PS4 and just kind of looking around for something to play. I picked up the Ratchet and Clank game from like 2017, and I was like, wow, this is great. It's like got really beautiful graphics, and everything blows up real nice, and there was something very tactilely stimulating about bashing a box and like having all the lug nuts and stuff like vortex towards you. I was like, man, this is great. And at that time I did have a PS3 I'd picked up on like Craigslist, so I was like, oh well, there's all these games you can play on the PS3, why don't we go with those? And so I started with like the PS3 ones, like Tools of Destruction, then worked forward from there. I was like, oh, these are all still pretty good. Why don't we go try out the PS2 games? And I was like, okay, I think we've reached the threshold. Let's stick with the PS3 games. But it was still, you know, educational to see like where the series had started from.
All right. So kind of conflicting approaches and or contrasting, I would say, approaches and opinions for you two. Whereas Stuart came in at the beginning of the PS2 era and feels like maybe the series might have dropped off after PS2. You came in and played sort of backward from PS4 and feel like, you know, looking actually chronologically, not in the order you played, but in chronological release order, the games get better. So that's interesting.
Wherever you start from, that's the best one.
Oh, there you go. Whichever one you fall in love with, whichever one you play when you're 9. Yeah. As for myself, I admit that this is a series that is kind of a blind spot in my video gameography, my game history. It's a series I've always meant to spend some time with and never really have. And, you know, reading through retrospectives and interviews and watching videos and so forth for to prep for this podcast, just, you know, kind of reinforce the fact that, yeah, I really want to play these sometime. It's just, who actually has time for video games? Gosh. So yeah, like it's a very appealing game, and you know, I kind of want to start by talking about the developers first. I mean, we can call Ratchet and Clank a franchise, and technically it is, but you know, franchise means there's lots of people who kind of have an ownership stake in it. Like when you talk about game franchises, it basically means someone starts the series and then, you know, kind of licenses it out to someone else, or, you know, farms it out to someone else. So like when you look at the Mario franchise, that's definitely a franchise because you've had all kinds of people making Mario spinoffs, Camelot and HAL and whoever else. Whereas with Ratchet and Clank, really there have only been a couple of games, a couple of the portable games that were not developed by Insomniac Games, the company that created Ratchet and Clank in the first place. So it really is more of a series, you know, that kind of stayed in-house and has had sort of the same creative leads behind it for nearly 20 years, which is very, very unusual in video gaming, especially with big franchises like this. And, you know, even for Insomniac, because back in the 90s, I think they kind of showed up on the radar for most people when they put together the Spyro the Dragon games. And we can talk about those a little bit, but those were really, really impressive for the time. And really, you know, were like kind of a convincing, finally, Sony had some games on PlayStation that were like, hey, this is, you know, of the caliber of this style of game that you'd find on N64, which had been sorely lacking to that point on PlayStation. So, you know, Insomniac really caught people's attention, but Universal owned the Spyro name and the property. So after Insomniac made like 3 of those games, they kind of moved along, and Universal was like, let's just give it to anyone. And so you have lots of Spyro games from lots of studios, some good, some not. Now Spyro is just a Skylander. He's a minor character in a defunct sub-franchise, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, no, they did the remakes, and they were pretty popular. The Reignited Trilogy.
Yes.
Yeah, they might get another chance with Spyro.
I hope so.
All right, well, there you go. But that is definitely a franchise, because Insomniac was only at the wheel for the first three games, and there have been far more than three games with Spyro. But Ratchet & Clank is really their baby, and you know, of all the games they've made, and they've made some pretty high-profile games of late, Ratchet is kind of the one that they keep coming back to, and even though it's been like 5 years since the last game, this episode is actually coincidentally timed for the release of a new game called Rifts in Time, I believe?
Rift Apart.
A Rift Apart, okay.
Yeah.
Which is not that's not smutty at all. What kind of subtitle is that?
No, I wasn't sure if I'd come up with an alternate for that one. No, I haven't. I haven't been able
to think
of one.
How about Rift You a New One?
See, that the thing is, that's good, but there is actually a weapon called the Rip You a New One
in Rift, the game. No, Rift You a New One.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
I don't know. I'm just spitballing here.
As we go through, I'll try and think of a worse one.
Okay.
Whatever we do, we just have to keep them away from the, you know, dummy thick or cheeks clapping lexicon. They cannot know about that.
Okay, yes. They're not allowed to know about that.
Insomniac must never learn about memes. So yeah, I would like to talk a little bit about Insomniac first, because I feel like they are kind of this plucky little studio once upon a time that basically got their start in publishing and development just on sheer chutzpah. Like, they had nothing. And they were like, we're going to go out and make some video games. And they somehow managed to go, like, a two-person studio with a little demo for PlayStation and 3DO. It was like, hey, Universal's, you know, you're this massive film and entertainment company. Why didn't you publish our game? And Universal was like, yeah, you should make three games for us. That's bonkers. Like, who does? You could not do that in this day and age. There's no way, like a two-person studio with nothing under their belt would go to like Disney and say, hey, look at us. We have an idea and we have a demo and you should give us a three-game deal.
It's always nice to think about those like basic roots for like them and Naughty Dog, like mm-hmm. making, you know, Way of the Warrior from Naughty Dog to like making this game with all their friends as like the fighters. And like now they're all both these monolithic companies. It's like, oh, you can still see in the near distance. Oh, they were a little once. They were like us once.
Yeah, we just recently, I don't know, a few months back did a Spyro the... They all kind of blur together. Crash Bandicoot retrospective episode, mm-hmm. and talked a lot about the origins of Naughty Dog and how they also just got by on sheer pluck and chutzpah. So a lot of strong fricatives there. Lots of chutzpah. but yeah, Naughty Dog and Insomniac, I feel, are kind of are two of the three stalwart Sony second party publishers. Basically, I don't know if they're entirely exclusive, but pretty much, along with Sucker Punch, kind of started out in the PS1, PS2 era, like basically the early 2000s, late 90s, making games for PlayStation, impressed people with the quality of the work they did, and somehow have managed not to be absorbed or dissolved or splintered apart, and, you know, have been behind some of the biggest games for the PlayStation brand in the past couple of years. I mean, Sucker Punch just published Ghosts of Tsushima. Insomniac, of course, is behind the Spider-Man games. Miles Morales just came out on PS5. And Naughty Dog, obviously, is behind The Last of Us, and already doing a reboot on that one. It's only been 10 years. Let's start over. Just like Spider, that's more of a Spider-Man thing, really.
I want to add very quickly. I think that Sony did actually buy Insomniac a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah,
I think okay. They own them lock, stock, and barrel, which means no more Sunset Overdrive, which is a good outcome for basically everyone.
Okay, I am mistaken about Insomniac then. But in any case, those are kind of like the three big Western studios that are sort of have been their long-term, like 20 years plus partners and just, you know, reliable hit makers for Sony. So yeah, did either of you ever play Insomniac's very first game, a PlayStation first-person shooter called Disruptor?
No, never, never.
Possibly extremely briefly, but not that it made an impression on me or anything.
Well, that is in keeping with that game's fortunes. Apparently, it was a... I did not play it either, but apparently it was an extremely good FPS, really kind of, you know, did cool things early on with PlayStation tech, and was published by Universal and got great reviews. And then Universal was like, marketing, what's that? And went absolutely nowhere. So basically that kind of put them out, but they were still tied to Universal for two more games. And, you know, were kind of embedded into the PlayStation ecosystem. And evidently based on an interview with Ted Price, who is the head of Insomniac and was the guy who started the company, back in the mid-90s, 25 years ago, he was talking to Mark Cerny, who, of course, is like the technology guru at Sony. And Cerny was like, you know, we don't have any really convincing family-oriented 3D platformers. Like, half of all the games on Nintendo 64 are those, and we have nothing. So maybe you guys could do one of those for us. And that's where we got Spyro the Dragon, which was... basically a combination of 3D platforming, collectathons, more kind of open flying mechanics, at least a lot of gliding, and featured the voice of the Taco Bell Chihuahua and music by the drummer from The Police, which is a really strange mix, but it was really good. A real technical showcase for PS1. I don't know if you two are familiar with the original Spyro.
Mm-hmm. I love that game, and one of my favorite PS1 games.
All right, tell us a little bit about why it's so good, because it is really good.
Okay, well, I'm doing one of my sort of jip hot takes in a way, because basically what I love about Spyro 1 personally is the fact that it's just kind of laid back. There is challenge in there, but it basically drops you in a world, and all there is to do is collect gems and flame enemies. There's no learning new skills. There's no swimming. There's no missions. There's no hockey, like there is in the second one. It's all just platforming and exploring and searching. There are a few flight levels, which is the closest thing it gets to being a gimmicky game. But with that sort of Stuart Copeland soundtrack, which is just fantastic, plus... the relative simplicity of the game, I find it's one of the easiest PS1 games to go back to, because so many of them I feel now have fussy controls that aren't quite as good as they need to be for what they're trying to do. Spyro is so simple. It's just charge, jump, flame, and everything pivots around that. You never, like I said, you never level up, you never learn anything new, you never go back to old levels with new skills. You can do everything the first time you go into a level, but you probably won't be able to because it's pretty well designed. Great game. Fantastic. Love it.
Yeah, I don't think that's a hot take at all. I think that's spot on. I really, like you said, it's a relaxing game or chill. Mm-hmm. And that perfectly defines it. It is a really sort of easygoing take on the platformer. And the soundtrack is a big part of that. Like Stuart Copeland didn't, you know, go in with trumpets blaring and, you know, hard rock or anything like that. It is this really kind of low energy, but sort of low key soundtrack, just very chill, has kind of like a nice groove to it. You know, obviously good percussion, like very sort of rhythm oriented, but mm-hmm. it just isn't really in your face. And I feel like that's like the most in your face thing about the game is the fact that, the main character is voiced by the Taco Bell Chihuahua, which is a very sort of late 90s thing. Like that's the most dated thing about it. But besides that, like it really did push the PS1 in a lot of ways and did things that you really didn't see happening on N64 with this style of game, like really long draw distances, really huge skyboxes, and actual, you know, like actual skyboxes, like not just, you know, a pixel graphic floating around eternally in the sky, but, you know, they actually built these spaces, which again, you just didn't see back then. So, it did kind of feel like Spyro came out of nowhere, but I kind of feel that's how everyone was back then. Like, you know, new studios were just kind of showing up out of the ether and being like, hey, check it out. We're going to blow your mind with like eyeball melting graphics. And you've never heard of us, but look at this thing we did. It was a great era.
It was probably the third and finest of the PlayStation 1 reptile trilogy, which is Croc, then Gex, then Spyro. I mean, you know how I feel about Gex. I'm a big fan, but
I mean, Gex isn't really a PlayStation brand. It's really a 3DO brand.
That's fair. Yeah, you're right. I take it back.
But that does give it some simpatico with Spyro, because Insomniac started, they had a 3DO dev kit when they started out. A 3DO dev kit and, like, a Sony dev kit. And fortunately, they ended up going with Sony, as opposed to putting their chips in with the 3DO. That worked out okay for Naughty Dog, but, you know, you can't all be Naughty Dog. So, yeah, anyway, Spyro was a big success. But like I said earlier, that property was owned by Universal. So, you know, obviously that really limited what Insomniac could do with it. So I think once their deal was up, they were like, yeah, Universal, you just kind of do your thing. We're going to go do something new that we can own. And spent like a year trying to figure out exactly what that was going to be. Like, it sounds like they had a tough time coming up with the actual concept of Ratchet and Clank and had a lot of false missteps in there.
Yeah, it seems like based on the final product, they were looking for something that was a little cooler than Spyro, maybe. Like, I don't know exactly how Spyro was perceived by people who played the game, but I always got the impression it was a little kiddier, and Ratchet's like meant for like teens. He's got attitude, he's got goggles. So they might have been trying to figure out how to capture that new distinct essence.
Well, you know, if you look at descriptions of the games they were kind of floating around internally before they came up with Ratchet and Clank, one of them was sort of a Tomb Raider style game that was, the operating name was Girl with a Stick. I don't know if that was going to be the final name. That's actually a really great name, very descriptive, mm-hmm. very evocative, but maybe not marketable.
No, Beyond Good and Evil was basically that, and that flopped.
Yeah, well, that was Girl with a Stick and a Camera, and a pig.
Fair play. Yeah, that's true. They did have the pig.
I think they were kind of going for the Tomb Raider thing and working to something that wasn't really their strengths. And I think internally, it sounds like everyone was kind of like, eh. And externally, people at Sony were like, yeah, guys, we don't know about this. So they scrapped it, which, you know, that's brave to do when you are a growing studio that's staffed up and probably have a pretty high burn rate in terms of staff and, you know, overhead and things like that. But they went back to the drawing board and came up with Ratchet and Clank, which is basically a friend of mine, a friend of the podcast, Nick Maragos, once described it as, let's see, this is what Mega Man in 3D has been trying to be. This was, you know, I think around the time of some false starts like Mega Man X7. And he was like, this is what Mega Man in 3D should actually be. Although, you know, all love to Mega Man Legends. It is a different kind of thing. Whereas this is like Mega Man, like classic Mega Man, where you just have all kinds of crazy weapons and it's, you know, just shooting and running around in science fiction. So like that's very appealing. And you know, even Ratchet and Clank went through a lot of iterative changes in development. Like Ratchet started out as more of a lizard man, and Clank was going to be three robots instead of one.
Ratchet and Clanks, I like it.
Ratchet and Clanks, yes. Ratchet and Clank and Clank and Clank. It's like, this is my name's Ratchet and this is my brother Clank. This is my other brother Clank. This is my other brother Clank. Are Newhart jokes too old for this podcast? Could be.
I was always more of a Bob Newhart show guy myself.
Okay.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay. Well, there you go. So yeah, they ended up going with more of a furry mascot type character, and basically what they ended up with was kind of a new take on Banjo-Kazooie, just in sort of the relationship between the characters, where you have Ratchet, who is this furry guy running around with a melee weapon, which is a wrench, you know, straight out of Half-Life. I guess that'd be a crowbar. I guess a wrench is more like, that was Beyond Good and Evil, wasn't it? Didn't Jade have a wrench at first?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
She did. Yeah.
I'm getting sidetracked. But you know, he runs around whacking things and shooting things, and then in his backpack he's got Clank, who occasionally, you know, he deploys to do stuff. And Clank has a more active role than Kazooie for sure. But you kind of get that sort of character dynamic of like the dominant character and then the secondary character. But I think it works, you know, from what I've admittedly the limited amount that I've played of the Ratchet games. Like, I feel like that balance works out really well. And even if the jokes don't always stick, it's still got like kind of a good hearted feel. It doesn't try to be too serious. Maybe it tries to be too funny without succeeding. But I think on the whole, they don't, you know, they don't crawl up their arsenal. They, you know, they manage to kind of keep it light and frothy, which I think is a good balance. Especially when you look at, you know, like the way the sort of Jak and Daxter sequels went, that was Naughty Dog's kind of character equivalent around this time, the PS2 like mascot vibe. You had Sucker Punch with Sly Cooper, and then you had Naughty Dog with Jak and Daxter, which went from kind of ugly mascot platformer, a little lighthearted, to like super grimdark and weird. Like it went way off the rails.
I find it fascinating just how intertwined the Ratchet and Clank series was with the Jak and Daxter series. And I'm not sure on the exact sort of chronology, but I'm pretty sure it was like Jak, the first one, which is basically really obviously just a reskinned Crash game.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second, then Ratchet comes out and the Jak guys go, oh, hey, guns. So they give guns to Jak, and I love that game and I will not hear any criticisms of it, even if they are reasonable. but then you start seeing like there are that Ratchet and Clank pop up in the later Jak games just as a kind of an Easter egg, like on posters and things. There's a joke in Ratchet and Clank where they do the celebration dance from Jak and Daxter when they collect one of the items. And then Ratchet turns up as a playable character in Jak X, and they just really seem like they were gelled really nicely.
Yeah, so the timeline on that is definitely Jak and Daxter came out first, because that was 2001. I remember because specifically my first ever trip to Japan was Christmas 2001, and I remember seeing a Jak and Daxter like character stand up in a game shop there. And those were not attractively designed characters, especially in the first game. Like they
look so weird.
Yeah. And it just, they seemed so out of place in that game shop. I was just like, what is this? It's terrible. It just looks so bad here. What's going on? And then, what are we talking about? Ratchet and Clank. Yes.
Yes.
That came out like a year later. But you know, they are more intertwined than just like alternating releases. Insomniac actually worked with Naughty Dog on some of the tech for Ratchet and Clank. They did not borrow the Jak and Daxter engine for Ratchet and Clank, like is sometimes reported, but they did get some rendering technology that basically their friends at Naughty Dog were like, yeah, here, let's collaborate on this. And so yeah, there may have been some like back and forth feedback with the sequel for Jak and Daxter. I don't know, but definitely these two studios, you know, they're pretty close and are, you know, close enough to share technology kind of within that PlayStation family. So definitely influences going one way and probably the other.
Hard to know if it was intentional, but yeah, like in the beginning of the second Ratchet and Clank for the PS2, like it's almost a de-escalation of the stakes, which is pretty funny compared to the how Jak 2 diverges, where like Ratchet and Clank are just sitting at home. They're like, no, we saved the universe. Kind of bored right now.
I love that opening so much.
Yeah, that's a real change of pace from Jak 2, which is like, well, you had an adventure. Now you're in jail for 10 years. Better grow a goatee.
What a game. What a great game.
But yeah, I don't know if Jak's dark turn can really be attributed to Ratchet and Clank. I think it was more like Grand Theft Auto and just the trends of that era. You know, everything was going darker, more serious, more mature, taking away all the color, adding more guns. So Jak and Daxter was definitely Naughty Dog saying like, we gotta chase that dragon. And Ratchet and Clank, I don't feel ever really did that too much, maybe outside of Deadlocked, which...
No, that was what they said about Deadlocked, but if you actually... I'm not saying like, if you actually like, that sounds so haughty, but if you play Deadlocked, it's not really that dark or any more dark than the other ones. It's just visually a little bit grimmer. That's all. Like, in terms of storyline, you've still got death and carnage in the older games. It's just a tiny bit grimmer in Deadlocked. It really is mostly comedic the whole time.
Yep.
But I feel that way about Jack 2 as well, so don't even get me started.
I'm very happy to be corrected about Deadlocked, because the fact that that was basically a multiplayer game was sort of the kiss of death for me. I was like, I'm not interested in this. So other people, like, who wants other people when you play video games? No thanks. I need some me time, not you time. So kind of the creative leads behind Ratchet and Clank, I pretty much picked out three, but maybe there's more and I'm just overlooking them. But you have to, you know, give credit to Ted Price, who founded Insomniac. And my impression of Ted Price has always been that he has been much more hands-on with game development. Like, he got into this business because he liked video games and wanted to make video games. And so he's not, you know, like someone who kind of vanished into the C-suite once they started making money. Like, he's stayed pretty active in game development. So even though he wasn't sort of the creative lead on Ratchet and Clank, he definitely had a lot of input into it. And you know, I'm sure as kind of the head of the company, he also is responsible in some part for sort of shepherding the series along. And you know, I can imagine there were times when Sony came along and were like, you know, gotta go grimmer, gotta go darker. We need, you know, something that's going to be hitting certain, you know, marketing notes. It's achieving certain ends. And
and that's when they dangled the Resistance keychain over on the
side. Right, right. Yes, I feel like, you know, from what I've played and seen of the Ratchet games, they never really strayed from their sort of central mission. And the more recent games, you know, even accounting for the fact that the most recent is a remake, they never really deviated too far from what the original game was about. So that's, you don't really see that too often. So, you know, I'm sure we have to credit Ted Price for that to some degree. But also a lot of credit, maybe the biggest amount of credit, goes to the director or creative director for the entire franchise, who's been with it from the start and is, you know, still like creative co-director, I believe, on Rift in Time. And that's Brian Allgaier. I don't know if I pronounced his name right, but he was someone who kind of started in video games around the time that Insomniac was being founded. He started out making CDI games. So obviously moving over to Insomniac to work on Spyro games was a big step up from CDI. And finally, there's David Bergeot. He's French, so hopefully I got the name right there. But he is an award-winning film composer. He's written all kinds of stuff, won all kinds of awards for the films he's scored, and he's composed most of the Ratchet and Clank soundtracks. So that's you know, it's good that he's willing to slum it a little bit.
Yeah, it feels like with the at least the first one, I distinctly feel like the entire soundtrack is like kind of the Matrix soundtrack, or like just very much. All I can hear in my head is Propellerhead. Mm-hmm. And over time, they, you know, they've really opened up like what they would do with the instrumentality and the musical choices. So, he's shown a pretty wide skill set there.
But I would say that, you know, a big part of the series' ability to endure and continue to be appealing does have a lot to do with the sort of creative consistency. You know, it's not a franchise. It is an Insomniac series, and the same people have been kind of guiding it and shepherding it from the beginning. So, again, that's really rare, especially in, you know, tentpole franchises like this. I mean, this isn't like Sony's top tier blockbuster. It doesn't get the same press as The Last of Us or something along those lines. You know, it's not even as big for them for Insomniac as Spider-Man Miles Morales, but it's still, you know, you get the impression that it's still something they believe in. And, You know, even if it's harder to sell a game like this as Sony's sort of personality changes and their priorities shift toward just big blockbusters and whatever controversial things Jim Ryan says, you know, they're still kind of keeping it real with Ratchet and Clank. So it's something I really admire about the series, and it makes me feel bad that I haven't played more of them.
I do worry a little bit that they might be victims of their own success when it comes to the Spider-Man games, because, you know, Spider-Man sold approximately 1 million D-billion D copies, and Ratchet and Clank 2016 appeared to do well for them, but, like, you know, not on the same scale as Spider-Man. So is someone going to come along and say, like, well, you make this Spider-Man game and it moves this many units, and you make this Ratchet and Clank game and it sells this many units, why don't you make two Spider-Man games, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I had that kind of a discussion set aside for the end of the show, but we can talk about that now, which is like, what do you think the future holds for Ratchet and Clank? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, Sony has come out very recently and said, we only believe in, you know, blockbuster tier games. That's all we want to invest in. They closed down their Japan studios, and they've really said, like, if a game doesn't deliver epic numbers, then why bother with it? Which, you know, that's frustrating, because I feel like with a studio like Insomniac, you have, you know, your Spider-Man, Miles Morales, you know, and that's going to be just raking in money hand over fist. And I feel like that should give them the leverage, the latitude to create games that aren't going to be competing with Grand Theft Auto 5 as most profitable game ever, but still, you know, profitable and still successful. Just not on the tier of, like, you know, we can build an entire platform strategy around this. But I feel like there needs to be room for, you know, not just those tiers of games, but for all tiers of games. But, you know, from Sony, I feel like there needs to be some of the smaller, like the sort of A-level games as opposed to just AAA. And it sounds like that's not the direction they're going. So I do wonder what that means for Ratchet and Clank in the future. Especially as you mentioned, Insomniac is now owned by Sony, so it doesn't give them the opportunity to, like, say, hey, Nintendo, this is your bread and butter right here. Like, can you imagine how good a Ratchet and Clank game would do on Switch, folks? You should let us develop for you. That's absolutely not going to happen. So I don't know what that means for Ratchet and Clank.
I mean, I was surprised that they even got the new game. I thought they were done. I thought after the remake, and the movie didn't do very well for them, and it was the remake was very heavily tied to the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought that I was just amazed to see they even got a new Ratchet game. The issue for me is, and this is not a popular view, but I feel like as the series went on, the fact that it did stay so structurally similar, I felt it kind of got boring, to be honest. And this new one, if it's going to be the same exact thing, but flashier with a solid state hard drive, and it costs whatever the American equivalent of £70 is, I don't know. I mean, I'll probably play it, but I mean, nobody has a PS5 hardly, because you can't get one. Kids certainly don't have them unless they're being bought them, which I imagine they're probably not. I don't know. It feels like not the best time to put it out. I mean, it'll have legs, because apart from Sackboy, which nobody really cares about, this is like the only, I guess, family-friendly major game on the PS5, from what I can think. I mean, I guess there's Bugsnax.
No, there's Astro's Playroom.
Oh, yeah, but that's built into it. That's free.
True, true.
Though it is really good. So I don't know. I mean, I hope it does well, because I do like these games. I also kind of hope that there's more to it than there was the last few. Not that I thought the last few were bad games at all, just kind of more of the same, and that does get old, I think.
Yeah, like, you know, not everything is lined up well for them here with the overall number of PS5s out there, but hopefully someone would look at, like, the, you know, the attach rate compared to, like, how many units sold versus how many are out there, and, like, yeah. In that sense, yeah, like, as you said, you know, when this game comes out, their competition will be Astro's Playroom, because, like, I don't think the people who are going to be playing RE8 and, like, Returnal, or even maybe, like, the FF7 DLC are going to really be the same market for as the Ratchet and Clank games.
Oh, whoa, it's going up against Balan Wonderworld.
Well, so much for Ratchet and Clank. But I do feel like Sony kind of okayed this Rifts in Time sort of as a test balloon to like just kind of float it out there and see how it does. And I feel like its performance is going to determine the future of the series. But, you know, something that kind of struck me, I was reading an interview on, I think, IGN with Ted Price, who said about the first game, what we were really trying to do was to make each other laugh and have fun. And we weren't thinking about too much about whether or not gamers would find it appealing because we're gamers. And we figured, hey, if this is what gives us incentive to come into work every day and allows us to be creatively free, it's probably going to have an audience. But I don't know if Sony agrees with that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, been really kind of disheartening, like the smaller scale games that have, it feels like Sony isn't interested in nostalgia or like remembering what made their systems fun to begin with. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who love, you know, what they're doing right now. So more power to them. But it is still a little, I'm trying to think of like the right word for like not color, not full of color.
Grim, dark, monochromatic, yeah. Dull.
Dour.
Any of those, is good, yes.
British.
Dour, yes.
Just gray, just so gray. And stodgy. Anyway, that's enough lamentations about the future. Let's talk about the past. This is, after all, Retronauts, not Futurenauts. God, who wants to be a Futurenaut? So depressing. So let's talk about the games and the characters. We'll start by talking actually about the characters, because they're kind of, you know, the driving element here. It's the characters and the guns, and then it's all the stuff that happens around them, basically. So obviously, the main characters are Ratchet and Clank. Ratchet is a Lombax, which sounds like a Dr. Seuss creation, but I assure you it is not. In the first game, he is kind of a teenage hothead, like just a little bit of a punk, and he's sort of hard to like. He's kind of mean to Clank, in my opinion. But, you know, I think they've softened him over time. He's matured, and not in like the mature kind of video game, M for immature. Not in that sense, but like the, you know, the sense of... He's just mellowed out a little, and he's not always a jerk. Then on the other hand, you have Clank, who is a robot. He is a tiny robot. I think people like to compare him to R2-D2, but really, the relationship is more like Twiggy and Dr. Theopolis from Buck Rogers. Because he's the little guy who's kind of stuffy and intellectual. Is this a good comparison, or are we into this?
I don't know what Dr. Theopolis is, I'm sorry.
Okay, so, Bill, are you familiar with Buck Rogers, the TV series from the late 70s, early 80s?
I'm familiar with its existence.
I've heard the name.
Wow.
Could I compare them to Sherman and Mr. Peabody, except Sherman's got like a gun?
Yeah, I guess. And Peabody carries Sherman around on his backpack?
Yeah, sure.
One other character worth mentioning is Captain Quark, who is, I would say, the most common recurring character in the series and is basically Zap Brannigan meets Blasto. Is that a fair comparison? Zap Brannigan meets... I'm totally blanking on the Toy Story guy.
Buzz Lightyear.
Buzz Lightyear, yes.
Buzz Lightyear,
jeez.
Yeah.
Okay, so kind of that personality. He is beloved by the galaxy, actually kind of a jerk, is working with the main villain in the first game, but they, I guess, rehabilitate him, kind of like the Marvel movies do with villains that characters like, or that audiences like. They're like, oh, that genocide he did wasn't that bad. He's lovable.
Yeah, he goes from trying to, like, straight up kill you to being just kind of a stupid waste of space, basically, who it thinks that he's the best.
So there are many, many more characters throughout the series, but those are the ones who are basically the mainstays. Like, the main villain of the first game is interesting because at first it seems like, wow, he's got this huge connection to Ratchet's past. Like, he's the guy who's responsible for, Ratchet basically being the furry little orange guy equivalent of the last son of Krypton. Like, he single-handedly destroyed Ratchet's planet. Wow, that's awful. But then he dies at the end of the first game. So, you know, you can't really build on that. I think that actually works out well for the series. So it's not just like Dr. Wily showing up again every time. I'll get you next time. None of that.
It's more like a rogues gallery, like Batman-esque, where like they take turns with the different villains being the head honchos in each game.
Mm-hmm. And the first villain is the first game is Chairman Drek, who basically is an Oddworld villain.
Yeah.
His schemes involve the destruction of natural habitats for personal gain. But remember that Ratchet is a Lombax, not a Lorax. He is not a Dr. Seuss character. You should not get those confused, even though they are suspiciously similar in theme and name. Ratchet's, you know, kind of pissed off at this guy, kills him, and everyone has a happy ending. So that's not, you know, that's not the only takeaway from the 2002 game. It really was a breath of fresh air when it came out. It was fast-paced, a very fluid action game. Insomniac is really good at games that feel good. I mean, that's the whole appeal of Spyro, really. Like, you just play it and it feels so easy. And this is the same way, except that instead of being a little dragon shooting flame, you're a lizard and a robot, or not a lizard, a Lorax and a robot who hit things with wrenches and then eventually gain like 36 guns and blow things up in amazing ways. And all of them are great.
It's very similar structurally to the first Spyro in that it basically you go from world to world. They seem sort of open, but they're quite linear. There is really one path through them and then maybe a second path going the other way. But basically every time you get to a new planet, you'll probably have enough bolts to get the next weapon. Or if you don't, you will in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
The economy is very sort of balanced in that sense. Similar to Spyro or the later Spyro games, you're going with each world, you've got your different sort of inhabitants of the world. So you're talking to them and you're being given like whatever mission. It is really structurally similar. They don't really start differentiating themselves for a couple of games yet, but it does work, I think.
All right, so the first game in the series introduced a lot of the trademarks. I mean, that would kind of run throughout the series, including obviously the characters, the galactic science fiction setting, the integration of mini games, some of which are good, some of which are not. Do you personally have favorite or least favorite mini game events in this first game, or actually any of the games?
Well, when we get to the, I'm sorry, go on, Stuart.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
For the PS3 games, at least, they seem to more distinctly like separate Ratchet and Clank, where it's like you'll have the Ratchet segment and the Clank segment, and usually that means like Ratchet usually plays the same from game to game, but Clank will have like a different puzzly, platformy game that he has to go through each time. And like the ones in A Crack in Time and Into the Nexus are pretty solid. Like the Crack in Time one I really liked is you sort of have to program Clank to walk along certain routes in these rooms and record his movement. And then while the copy of Clank goes along that path, you like have to jump along somewhere else. Like you record Clank walking over and punching a switch. And then the copy goes over and does that, and then you have to jump to where a platform is going to raise up when he hits that switch and then continue across to the next part. And it gets pretty like intricate with like three or four copies going at once. And while I did enjoy it, I also appreciate that they did say like, hey, this stuff is all optional. The only thing you get for it is more money. If you don't like it, just go left.
I found the second half of the game, those get so difficult for me. Like the level of thinking that was required was not what I was prepared for. I was like, I want to break boxes. I don't want to think. Going back to this sort of original game, I liked the Trespasser minigame where you have to shine lasers to open doors. I did enjoy that, but I didn't enjoy the... No, that's not the Trespasser. That's the lock thing. Is it the Trespasser? I don't even know. They have stupid names. Whichever's the thing that opens doors, then later you get a disguise which disguises you as an alien, and you have to do these weird rhythm action conversations that are really boring and long and hard. I didn't enjoy those very much, but the best minigame in the whole series, for my money... In Ratchet 3, you've got the Quark Vid comics, which are 2D side-scrolling levels that are very much like Mega Man. They're really, really fun. They're really, really fun.
I did not play those, but I have seen them being played and was like, yep, okay, that Mega Man comparison, it's finally come home to roost.
Well, in that era, I mean, I'm sure... Correct me if I'm wrong, there wasn't really that much 2D platforming going around because indie hadn't really broken out yet.
Right.
But
it was Game Boy Advance or nothing.
Yeah, basically. So it was nice to play a kind of attractive AAA graphic looking 2D thing that handled fairly well. I did enjoy that quite a lot.
And I know there was, I think, a minigame in the first or like a weapon or something that Clank could use where he could send out little drones of himself.
Yeah, you command around the sort of gadgetbots that you find. They're a little bit like Munch's Odyssey, but that came later, I think. You can get them to follow you, you can get them to attack. It's very much like kind of an Oddworld thing, and they're integrated into the levels quite well, I thought. They're never particularly difficult, but they are interesting.
Munch's Odyssey was a launch title for Xbox 360.
Oh, wow.
The original Xbox. So, yeah, that would have been 2001. So.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that was already out then. There we go. It sucks.
What's that?
Munch's Odyssey, it's terrible.
All right. This is not an Oddworld podcast, though, so...
Good.
Are you a fan of any of those games?
Yeah, I love Oddworld, I just don't like Munch's Odyssey.
Oh, okay.
I don't like what they did with it.
All right. So, yeah, the big thing, like I said, is the weapons in Ratchet & Clank. There are more than 30 distinct weapons you can acquire, or tools, some of which are, you know, more utility than destructive. But one nice thing about it is you just have them on hand. Like, you have, you know, the ability to use them whenever you want, as opposed to, like, something like Mega Man Legends, where you have, like, a bunch of kind of cool weapons, but you can only take one into the dungeons with you at a time. It's like, what do you want to equip for this mission? So, yeah, you don't have to worry about that. And apparently they had a list of like, they did brainstorm and came up with like 70 or more weapon ideas and then whittled it down. But it wasn't a case where they whittled it down to like, well, here's like the five best. They were just like, here's 30, here's 35. Let's just, you know, go crazy. Let's have, you know, basically like a black hole bomb. Let's have, you know, a grappling wire. Interestingly, they said the grappling wire ability was specifically inspired by Spider-Man. So, making their sales pitch way back in 2002.
Paid off for them. Good stuff.
Yeah, and to your point, Jeremy, about the scarcity of resources, like, it's the combat is not built around that. Like, ammo is everywhere. You're encouraged to switch to a bunch of different weapons and try them all out. And while this isn't part of the original game, like, they give you strong incentives to, you know, try out all the weapons and level them all up as they get more and more powerful when you deal more damage with them. So it's fun, and you are given fun things to do when you diversify.
So this game was remade in 2016 as a tie-in with a movie that apparently came out amazingly. Wow. Who knew?
Yeah. Nobody remembers that movie, really.
But how would you say the remake compares to the first game? I know, Bill, you were very impressed by the remake enough to want to go back to the original. But like, what do they change? How is it different? How is it the same? Just, you know, aside from the obvious visual gloss they put over it, like what's the deal?
Well, in terms of the story, they added a lot more wrapping around what's going on. Like it's all contextualized as Captain Quark is in prison and he's retelling the story, but he's giving like his editorialized version of what happens in the original Ratchet and Clank. Like I guess you would say in the original one, you play as Ratchet and you see Ratchet's point of view, but this is him like adding in details of what happens and like narrating events and like, sometimes humorously, sometimes less so, like giving gameplay pointers as you go. And, they also like kind of deepen the lore of Ratchet here, where it's like in the first game, you know, you see the cutscene, it's just like Clank shows up, Ratchet finds Clank, they go off on an adventure. But now it's like Ratchet yearns to be a space ranger. He wants to get off this dusty old planet, and like, you know, get out into the galaxy.
Goes out and looks at the twin moons as the Force theme plays.
Basically.
Never gets to go into Tosche Station to pick up power converters.
And like the very first thing you do, the way they integrate the tutorial into the game is you're going to a Space Ranger's tryout. And he flunks it because he's not Space Ranger's material. He's too tiny, you see. So the rest of the game is like him like getting further wrapped up in the Space Rangers and like still following the same overall beats of the story, but him like doing it with a little bit more tension between him and Clank, him having like... He lies and says he is a space ranger to Clank when they first meet. And Clank, being a naive little robot who just like walked off an assembly line, believes him. And then just with another big thing they change with the game, which is more mechanical, is they don't make you buy the upgrades anymore. Which when I went back and played the original, I was like, you're making me buy the propeller pack? But I want to buy a gun. I can't buy a gun anymore. You're making me buy the... So when I played the remake. I went back and played the original. Then I went back and played a little bit more of the remake just to refamiliarize myself. And I was like, oh, thank God, they don't make me do that anymore. Good.
I hate to admit it, but I think I do think, I mean, as much as I loved the original from playing it when I was younger, I do think the remake is more fun. If only because it takes the quality of life stuff that came later in the series and applies it to the first game. You know, you've got proper luck strafe, you've got proper quick select wheel, you can level up your weapons, which you can't in the first game, you can level up your health, etc. It's basically the first game if it had been made after the third game, I think. And it does work really well. The only bad thing about it, and this is, I say bad as in broadly sort of game community speaking, is it, until recently it ran at 30 frames per second, not 60 like the original, but now it does run at 60 on a PS5 because they patched it. And it's great at 60. It's beautiful.
Insomniac stopped making its PS4 games, I think even PS3 games, to run 60 frames per second because they felt, please don't let the gamers hear this, but they felt that it doesn't really impact sales or reviews. They feel like it's better to have games that look great and handle well than games that have silky smooth frame rates. Do not tell the gamers. They will be so angry. But yeah, the remake is interesting. It sounds like they really kind of came up with a good pretext for it. It's basically Rashomon and Clank, which is that's pretty good. I like that. I like, you know, kind of taking this long running character, sort of the who's, you know, kind of a spoiler character, you know, a nemesis almost in the first game, and giving him something to do beyond just like, hey, I'm a bad guy. Well, you beat me, I'm going to go away.
Yeah, and they found pretty good ways to like nod at the other games that had come later but could not be included. Like they have references to it where when Ratchet goes to apply for the Space Rangers, apparently he's been a little bit roguish in the past that had not been revealed before. And it's like, didn't you like break time and like stop, you know, harbor a dangerous dimension alter? And he's like, I had good reasons for doing that. You know, wink and a nudge to like the old stories from the old games.
Okay. So the framing device takes place like later in continuity. It's not immediately after the events of the first game.
I think it's fudged enough that you don't really know, if that makes sense. It's kind of... there isn't, like, a specific sort of canon for it, not from what I can recall anyway.
Hmm. Okay.
But it is implied that they are giving themselves the leeway of saying this is a retelling. This is not the canon new beginning of the series, because the new game, Rift Apart, seems to be basically the next game after Nexus, I think. They're okay. Just disregarding the big gap between it and Nexus.
If I had to guess, they were looking for a way to, like, if the movie took off and if the game broke, you know, records, like, they could jettison all the other continuity. But now that, like, the movie is barely remembered, they can be like, okay, well, we'll go back and just pretend that this stuff still happened.
Well, in terms of the quality of life stuff, I'm always a big fan of remakes that do that, where they basically pull in the content, the structure, the, you know, the design, the story of the original game or an older game, but apply just, you know, improvements and advancements to those. Like, I think Tomb Raider Anniversary was a pretty good example of that, where they basically took the, you know, the PS2, PS3 generation type improvements that we saw in the Tomb Raider games with, like, Underworld and whatever the one was before that.
Legend. Tomb Raider Legend was the first.
There you go. That's the one. So they basically took that framework and then said, okay, but what if we did this with, you know, the actual content of the first game, which in my opinion was, you know, probably the most interesting and intriguing of the Tomb Raider games, just because it was so, you know, it had that kind of, like, solemnity, that Metroidist quality where you were just like, hey, I'm just a girl in a cave. Sometimes I got to shoot bats, but mostly I'm just exploring.
You feel really vulnerable, I think, even though you are tooled up. You feel really vulnerable, like in Metroid, even though you're in a power armor suit. You feel that anything could come out of anywhere and get you.
Right. At any point, you could accidentally take a bad jump and land in that acid and not be able to jump out and, like, fall in a tall pillar or something and just die. Yeah, and the original Tomb Raider was like that. Like, hey, you see this interesting statue? Why don't you go climb on it? Oh, it turns you into gold and you're dead. Oh, too bad. So, a little bit mean, but yeah, like, this sounds very much along those same lines. I don't want to turn this into a Tomb Raider podcast either, but it does put me in mind of that. And that's always, you know, a good standard to kind of live up to.
The only thing other than what I've already mentioned that I didn't like about the remake is, as something Bill sort of alluded to, it has that thing that a lot of modern games do, and it sounds so foggyish, but it tells you what to do all the time. It's constantly just like invoice over. And Ratchet found out that the weak spot of the boss was this point. Shoot this point now with your gun, you know? And the original game did have tooltips, but it wasn't quite so on the nose about it. Mm. And I do find that kind of stuff quite frustrating, because the game isn't even remotely difficult.
Like, sometimes they do realize what they're doing. Like, they're like, and Ratchet realized he cannot breathe underwater. You know, stuff like that, insipid. But, like, there are times where it is sincere, and it's like, okay, I get it. Yeah, I shoot the thing. Thank you.
So it's kind of doing the Prince of Persia thing, the reboot, the Sands of Time thing, where you're telling the story and, like, no, that's not how it happened when you die.
I don't think it does that anything that sort of clever, though. That's a good example you mentioned with the water, because I was playing this quite recently, and that there's a section in Ratchet & Clank 1 where you'd go down into a tunnel and the water starts rising. And it's genuinely quite tense, because you have to keep ahead of the rising water, but then there's a section at the end of that where you have to swim no matter what, and you'll only have enough air if you've been keeping sort of ahead of where you need to be. And in the remake, that same section is in there, but the whole time it's happening, either the voiceover or the characters are going like, uh-oh, oh no, the water's rising, oh boy, and it just kind of takes some of the... I just feel kind of like, you know, I get it. I know that this is a tense situation because I'm playing it. I'm in it right now. I don't need to be like, have that hammered over my head like this. But again, it doesn't really matter that much. It's fine.
I will always appreciate the remake for simplifying the like long jump or propeller jump mechanics where...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The original feels like the instructions to a dance you do at a wedding, where it's like, first you start running. Then you press R1. Then you press triangle and release R1. It's like,
In the original, it's the same basic command as the long jump in Mario, but without the visual sort of feedback or makes that feel so tactile. So yeah, I do agree that they improved it by just sticking it on R2.
We'll be right back. All right, so we've had a lot to say about the first game, but we should talk about the sequels and just kind of track the evolution of the series. I think we have plenty of time for that. So, and it sounds like you've played most of them. So, 2003, we got Going Commando. Basically, this was an annual franchise for nearly a decade. Actually, for more than a decade. Looks like 11, 12 years. So, what did Going Commando bring to the franchise besides, you know, a continuation of the story?
Well, that was the one that first added the upgradable weapons and health, which adds, like, I cannot overstate how important that was to the series for me, because once you have a reason to use all the weapons, you will use all of them. You will not just stick with the best, like the Devastator, like in the first game. In this one, you use everything because you want to know if when you level it up, it's going to turn into something insane. Because they not only do they level up, they also have evolved into like much more powerful, more exciting, interesting versions of themselves. And that went a long way. This was also much harder, so you needed to have those upgrades as well.
So when you say upgrades to weapons, like it's not just better firepower, it's like actual material changes to the weapons.
Yeah, annoyingly, I can't think of any examples off the top of my head. It introduces the Bouncer, which is my favorite Ratchet and Clank weapon ever, where you fire it. It's like a sort of largish, maybe sort of soccer ball sized projectile that splits into about six smaller versions of itself that make this fantastic clang-a-lang sound while they're all bouncing all over the place, like ding 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 ding, like a pachinko machine or something. But it's a pachinko machine of death, basically. And once you level it up, once you get the Mega Bouncer, instead of a six, you'll be shooting, say, like 28 of them. And if you fire it into a room, it's just complete like cacophony, and then everything's dead, and it just never stops feeling awesome to use.
I actually can't believe that I've never played a game from Japan that has some sort of weaponized pachinko in it. That's amazing. So it sounds like we beat them at their own technology. No, that sounds very satisfying. Like the idea of upgrading weapons like that and having such unusual weapons is very satisfying too.
Yeah, they had in the first Ratchet, there was a gun that turns your enemies into chickens. That was about as out there as they got, I think. The second game had, I want to say, sheep. That was kind of a thing for a while. You would get a gun that turned your enemies into a different animal, different sort of farmyard animal. But yeah, Going Commando is just, it's very similar gameplay-wise, but the fact that they did add these systems on top of it did make it a lot more compelling, I think, personally.
Billy, you've played these more recently, I assume. Do you have any thoughts on what Going Commando brought to the series?
Nothing specific, I'm afraid. Just, I guess what I thought starting out, jumping from Going Commando from the original, is like, it's pretty heavy combat elements at the start, and like it's more just like you're diving right in. There's not any like introduction. It's like, you know, you know who these characters are. You know why you're here. Let's just go and play some games and shoot the robots. And I think the leap for me started with Up Your Arsenal, where like that was the first one where it really felt like, ooh, this is starting to feel like more of a modern 3D action game, where the camera is like really responsive and combat's starting to feel really smooth and responsive and slick and stuff like that.
Okay, well, we can jump ahead to Up Your Arsenal. That's 2004's game. Yeah, so good. That was the third game in the series. What did that one bring to the mix? Instruct me, inform me, edify me.
It was kind of another focus shift, because the platforming has been reduced a little bit here. It's much more based around shooting. There's a lot more... As you said, the camera is a lot more responsive. It's a lot more like a third-person shooter normally is now. You can put the aiming targeting, you can put it on the shoulder buttons like a modern game. It's got even more leveling up, even more weapons, post-game mega weapons, challenge mode, those 2D levels I mentioned already. The hub stage set on a starship makes you feel like, I guess, there's something happening in the plot. You're going back to this location with this team, and you feel like you're part of a team, and It's actually quite funny. The script is quite amusing. It's still obsessed with crotch jokes, but there are some genuinely funny cutscenes. The one that stands out for me, sorry for the spoilers, there's a part of the game where they think that Quark is dead, that he's kind of sacrificed himself for the mission, and they have a funeral for him, and it's the funniest funeral I've ever seen.
Because, you know, funerals are usually just laugh a minute.
You can't spell funeral without fun.
That's true. I feel like there's a Prince Philip joke in there somewhere, but I'm not going to make it.
It's too soon. It's too soon to make a joke about that racist old zombie. It's too soon.
All right, Bill, you mentioned really liking Up Your Arsenal and really feeling it was a big leap over the previous games. So in what sense do you feel that's the case?
The main thing that jumped out to me was the camera controls. Like in the first couple of games, like, I'm, you know, for the time, having played other games at that in that era, like, I can understand how we got there, but the camera movement feels more like a suggestion. Like, you want to go right? I can give you about 10 degrees right. Okay, you want more? But in this Up Your Arsenal, now it's really starting to feel like, okay, we can, like, get a full accounting of the battle. Like, the number of enemies is feels like it's up. Like, there's more happening on screen when you're running around, but the game is still handling it well, and, like, the frame rate isn't dropping. That's really where it shines to me.
It expanded on something they introduced in Going Commando, which is the whole battle arena gameplay. Because Up Your Arsenal has a battle arena you can visit sort of optionally eventually, where you'll basically go through a series of round-based, gladiator trials, I guess, combat trials, with different rules and different rewards if you complete them. And it's just a really great way to keep you playing the game, because the last one of those trials is 100 rounds, and the rules change in every single round. And it's absolutely brutal, and the only way you're going to do it is if you've already been through the game on challenge mode a couple of times and leveled up all your stuff and given yourself max health. And it just feels really good and really rewarding to get stuck in, because it's the first time that you're not wrestling with the controls to do so. Because you could strafe in Going Commando, but it just didn't feel good. But in this game, you can set yourself to default, like, third-person shooter controls, and it feels fantastic. Great game.
And most importantly, like, we really get into the deep lore of Secret Agent Clank.
Yes, exactly.
Right, and that eventually became its own game, which apparently, Stuart, you do not like.
To me, it's the worst Ratchet game, or the worst game in the series. It sucks. I really didn't enjoy it. It's not really a Ratchet game, it's a Clank game, and the Clank levels are fun as a bit of variety, but not for a whole game, and certainly not for stealth. No chance. No thank you.
Yeah, so fill me in. What is Secret Agent Clank exactly? Like, the concept? This is one of the games that I demoed. Man, it must have been Tokyo Game Show, like, 2007. I think it was one of those events that Sony had at their studios back when they cared to invite press to do things aside from, you know, like, stranding them on a boat to look at, not look at Vitas. Yeah, so, like, I got that it was kind of a minigame collection for PSP, but what's the, not minigame, but, like, I don't know, sort of a mission-based, bite-sized kind of adventure for PSP, trying to figure out what to do with a portable system. But the overall concept, like, where does that come from?
I can't remember the exact context, but yeah, it's. I think it's the show that Clank is the star of in-universe. Is that right, Bill? It's been a while since I've played it.
Yes, yeah. Clank stars in a series, Secret Agent Clank, in the universe, and is, like, you know, galactically famous, which...
Yeah, and Ratchet's kind of salty about it.
Yeah.
But then they... Because it's basically a gag that they spin off into its own game, and they should not have.
All right. So you mentioned the arena element, which is basically the jumping off point for the fourth game, Deadlocked. Yeah. I feel like when you have these game series, the point where they hit the fourth game is usually where things start to get a little weird. They're like, what are we, like, Gears of War 4, Halo 4, Deadlocked, like, they kind of start looking around and saying, well, how do we freshen this up? We've done three of the same thing. And so with Deadlock, they went for the arena style, the arena shooter element, really played down the story. I remember, you know, seeing previews of it, seeing preview builds of it at work and watching people play and just thinking, like, this doesn't have the stuff that interests me. Like, I, you know, what little time I've spent with the series, this isn't going to be the one to pull me in.
It's one of those games where I totally get why people don't like it. I think it's great. I really enjoyed this one. It is all mechanics though, like, and I think that the actual shooting is really tight and really good. The fact that it is multiplayer with split screen for the whole campaign is a big draw for me because I still love split screen gaming. There's lots to do, and it's one of the only Ratchet games that's actually hard because you can turn the difficulty up really, really high and just have a lot of fun with it. But all the same, it's not Halo, it's not Half-Life 2, you know, it's not, and it kind of is more in competition with those games than it is with a Ratchet game, mm-hmm. and it can't help but look not as good compared to more contemporary third-person shooters, I guess. It's not bad, but I get why it's not liked.
Bill, did you spend time with this one, or did you just say, eh?
I forewent all the PSP games, the Secret Agent Clanks, the Deadlocked, the Size Matters is...
I thought Deadlocked was a PS2 game.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're probably right about that.
People don't even know this game. That's how unknown it is. Like, no shame in it.
It's the disruptor of the series.
Yeah, it's the Jack X of the series.
Whoa.
And I love Jack X. I'm the only guy who does.
Someone's got to.
You know, they put a joke in The Last of Us Left Behind where Ellie plays on a Jack X arcade machine and then says it sucks, and then you get a trophy that says, like, can't win them all. And I was like, I resent that. I resent that so much, Naughty Dog. Don't be ashamed of your awesome Jack karting game.
Okay, so Deadlocked was the first game not to have a smutty subtitle. So, Stuart, would you like to grace us with your pick here? Oh, I think you did already, actually.
Yeah, Lock Blocked. But then I remembered that Crack in Time was originally called Clock Blocked.
Oh,
so
no.
It's not as good. All I could come up with this was Hot Under the Collar, but it sucks. I've just not done a good job here. And I feel like I've let Retronauts down, and I'm sorry.
It's okay. There's probably an innuendo there about showering with a friend or something since it's co-op, but I don't know what that is. All right. So you get on, the series skipped a year. It lay fallow for 2006 and came back in 2007 with the first non-PlayStation 2 release, a PlayStation portable game that brought back the smutty innuendo subtitle. That is Ratchet & Clank Size Matters for PSP. And as probably should be expected, I do remember looking at this one and, you know, it's a first-party Sony PSP game, so it looked freaking amazing, like, for the platform. You know, Sony's stuff was right up there with Square Enix, just like, hey, look at what we can do with this hardware. Even if the game's not great, you cannot believe that you can hold a game like this in your hands. It's so beautiful.
It's really good for what it is, which is a smaller scale Ratchet game that they crammed onto the PSP. I thought they did a darned good job. It's short and it's not difficult and it's got fewer of basically everything, as you'd expect. But for a handheld game, it's super impressive, I think. The only problem with it is there's a glitch where basically every time from, I think, Ratchet 2 onwards, every time you beat the game, you can play it again in challenge mode. And it gets harder and it scales up your multiplier for how many bolts you get. And I believe in this game there's some glitch where it gets harder but it doesn't scale up. So after a while it just stops working properly and you stop getting the reward you're supposed to get, which is really, really weird. I don't know if there's a way to circumvent it, and I don't know if what I've just described is an entirely accurate description of the problem. Someone will be able to leave a comment and, you know, call me a fat idiot or something, and that would be fine.
Okay. So that was the first PSP game, but it did make its way to PlayStation 2, as often happened for Sony first party games. I think God of War also showed up on PS2. They were like, you know, let's milk this. Also, you know, PSP games to kind of develop at that spec, it required a pretty hefty investment. And I don't think PSP games always necessarily made back the investment. I think those were more like prestige pieces. So, you know, putting them on a platform that was basically the best-selling, most installed platform of all time, that's a pretty good way to guarantee you're probably going to recoup your losses because it's not that big an effort to backport from PSP to PS2. And, you know, you've got 120, 150 million kids just dying to play it, probably. So, you know, at the same time that Size Matters came out on PSP, there was another Sony platform out there, the PlayStation 3. And those of us who got second jobs so that we could afford to buy one could play Tools of Destruction, the first PS3 game for the series. And Bill, I know you've played this one because you said so.
I did say so, yes. Yeah. This is the first game I checked out after the PS4 one, and like now having the further context of the other games to work from, like I think it does continue like the evolution from the original trilogy, like bringing up the fidelity, the feel of the combat's improved, and I think they did a good job bringing the story further along too. Like, you know, the story doesn't have to be the main focus of everything here, but it's nice to have a little bit of stakes for the main character. Like, you know, Ratchet up until this point kind of just floated along. He's just like, up, oh, Clank shows up, I go off and I save the universe. And now it's like he has like an emotional attachment to the things that are happening around him and like exploring the mystery of what happened to his people. So this is what kind of kept the momentum going and got me to keep trying out the other PS3 games with mixed results.
Do they all live in a little bottle in a tiny city called Camdor?
Yes.
Yes, they do. And Ratchet has to sit in his, you know, ice house constantly and watch over it with his many robotic counterparts.
You know, that's what the Snyder movies are missing is Candor.
Yeah, in more ways than one.
All right. So, Stuart, how do you feel about this one? You said that PS3 is where things kind of started to trail off for you.
Yeah, but this game for me isn't where that started. I think this is a really rather good one. It feels like a continuation of the gameplay from Up Your Arsenal. It doesn't have much in the way of, I guess, gimmickry. It's basically a much nicer looking Ratchet game, and honestly, apart from the fact that it's sort of sub HD, it still looks really remarkable. I think looks like a really, really nice looking game. I wish they'd stick it on the PS4 or the PS5, but you know, I don't know. They don't seem to care about their legacy, so they probably won't. But it's difficult for me to say much about it because it's basically just more of the same, but it's good. It is a good one. I did enjoy this one quite a lot. The only thing that I didn't get on with is one of the weapons uses the 6-axis and it controls like crap. Because it's basically, yeah. I think it was the tornado. You fire a tornado and then you have to move the tornado by tilting your controller. And as much as I advocate gyro controls, I advocate them once they became good. And they were not good at this point, unfortunately. They were bad. So basically, whenever I play it, I look like my mom trying to play a video game, where she thinks that turning the controller clockwise and anti-clockwise makes the character move.
Yeah, likewise, they gin up a few different scenarios where Ratchet, never having done this before in a game, has to like skydive down from a high distance.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that stuff, yeah.
And you have to use the 6-axis to like move out of the way of missiles rushing up at you.
Yeah, that sounds like something I would hate. I really did my best to avoid games of that era with 6-axis gimmicks. Like, motion control gimmicks worked okay on Wii because the controller was really designed around it, but the 6-axis, it wasn't. It was just like a thing they grafted onto it.
You weren't a big fan of Lair, then?
I was absolutely not. They did patch it to be playable normally, right?
I don't have a clue.
Okay. So moving beyond Tools of Destruction, there's a game that I think I've heard of before, but I know nothing about it, which is Quest for Booty. What is this?
This game is so unremarkable, it didn't even get a physical release in the US.
It's a bit of a sort of prologue to Crack in Time. It sort of bridges Tools of Destruction and Crack in Time with a sort of pirate-based storyline, which I think spins out of Tools, because those pirates appear in that game, I think. But it's a weird one, because there's not much shooting in it. It's mostly doing platforming and kind of puzzling, because Clank's not in it at all, if memory serves. He does not show up in this game, apart from maybe in cutscenes, because he's been separated from Ratchet at the end of Tools of Destruction. Sorry for the spoilers. Now, I used to have a physical copy of this, which I then got rid of, and I regret it because the price is soaring now, because they're going to shut the PlayStation store and you won't be able to get this anymore. Yeah, well, at least I've still got my 3D Dot Game Heroes, which I'm going to retire on. So, yeah.
Good deal. So the reason I haven't heard about this one is because it's like an interquel, like a little filler between two games, I guess. They couldn't get away from that annual release schedule. They had a 2007 game and then Crack in Time in 2009. They were like, oh, we got to do something in between. But I think clearly we've moved beyond that now that it's been 5 years between the remake and Rift in Time. So that's good. But how does this lead into Crack in Time? What is Crack in Time all about? Someone wrote in here, it's the most Pixar-ish of the lot.
Yeah, it's really... Now, this is for me, this is one of the most acclaimed games in this series, so this actually is one of my JIP hot takes, so strap in. I don't like this game, and I wish I did, because they really clearly threw everything into it. Like, they put so much effort and love into it, and you can tell that they care about it deeply. But unfortunately, in making it a lot more movie-like, they strip out, in my opinion, a lot of the character in favor of emotion and drama. And there's nothing wrong with those things, and some of the moments in the game, I think, actually do kind of work. But the thing is, Ratchet and Clank, they're not that interesting as characters. They're kind of just ciphers. They're just kind of there. And I like them because they're fun, but you don't... And I'm speaking for myself, obviously. I don't really care about them. And if when they get separated, yeah, it's a shame, but then there's this whole story about Ratchet's dad or something, and I don't really care about that either. And they really, really want you to care. They really want it to be a huge deal, and it just never feels like it, because the whole of the rest of the series is just them laughing at a plumber's ass crack for 10 games. So it's like, okay, we suddenly, you've gone from the plumber's crack to, I've got...
Plumbing the depths of your emotions.
Plumbing the, yeah, exactly, a crack in time. A crack in time. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's obviously put a lot of effort into it, and people who say this is my favorite one, I'm kind of like, yep, I totally get it, but it's not my favorite. I feel like it loses a lot of character in favor of, I guess, the more kind of PlayStation Studios kind of worthiness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I'm going to be the one of the people who says, yep, this is my favorite one.
So you have a very lukewarm take to counterbalance Stuart's hot take.
yeah.
Excellent.
So I do agree that the story is a little overwrought and doesn't really enhance the goings-on. Like, the main thing is, like, they introduce a father figure for Ratchet. His name is Azimuth, and he is another Lombax. And, you know, it's like they're working together to try and bring back all the other Lombaxes from wherever they went. But why is Azimuth not with the other Lombaxes? Oh, he has a dark story to that. And, you know, you can take or leave that. But I think the stuff in between all the story moments, like, that's really where they did, like, really make it into something bigger and more ambitious than what Ratchet and Clank had been before. Like, with the spacefaring segments before, you know, you just kind of, like, when you were going from one world to the next, it was a menu. You know, when you scroll through a menu, you go to the planet, there's a cutscene, you're there. But now you go to a system and you can fly around the system. You can land on the moons and do like a singular objective on the moon. You can have space-based missions. Like, you'll, you know, the enemies in this game, like, they'll, you know, launch a fighter patrol at you, and you have to, like, defeat 20 of them and stuff like that. And, like, adding light open world elements, like, I thought that was pretty cool. Like, it made the game feel bigger, the world feel more lived in. And then when you get into the traditional Ratchet and Clank stuff, I feel like that's even better than before. And, like, they they added a new upgrade for this game, the jet boots, and that, in addition to like the, you know, the swing line and the rail grinding you already had, just makes it even more fun to traverse these worlds. That like, it's a joy to have to, you know, jet between point A and point B on the map now. And like, I think since then they've scaled back some of the wild ideas they had for this one, and I kind of miss that. I think they kind of do need to explore some of this stuff again, maybe in Rift Apart, or, you know, we'll see if there's any future entries after Rift Apart, but like something that does shake up the formula a little bit.
I don't know why I keep calling Rift Apart Rift in Time. I'm sorry. That's not my only takeaway from this, but no, it does sound like a very enjoyable game to play. I kind of regret having missed out on it, even though I would probably just press, you know, whatever you press to skip past the cutscenes because they sound kind of interminable. But the concept of like a kind of an open, exploratory almost Ratchet and Clank, that kind of hits the one point that is an instant winner for me. So I will have to look this one up.
It doesn't quite hang together for me, but because the aforementioned space battles, for example, it's like sometimes you just want to go to a planet and you can't because you've got to shoot down 25 fighters and then their mothership before you can do that. And the space battles aren't difficult when they're not particularly interesting either. They start easy and then you get more upgrades for your ship and they just become easier.
So on a scale of gummy ship, like one to gummy ship, where do you rate these space battles?
Oh, God. Sorry, wait. Gummy ship is the top mark?
No, it's like, I guess, you know, for super annoying, superfluous, like, right. Don't include this.
Because if one is nothing and the gummy ship, I mean, that's one to two, what you're basically saying. I don't know. They're okay. They're fine. I'd probably give them a five. They're a pass. But I just don't want to do them. And you got to keep doing them, unfortunately. I thought that the jet boots were cool, but what they essentially amounted to, in my humble opinion, is because you can move so much faster and further so quickly, they just make the planets really big with a lot of space to jet across. Where normally you'd have a kind of a tight little combat arena, it's just like vast. And there are some moments where that scale pays off. There's a really great bit towards the end of the game where you go back in time to a battleground in the middle of the battle, which is really tricky and fun and good, and then you return to the present having changed history. That stuff works, but they don't really do a lot with it. It really is just set pieces like that. But again, it's clearly polished to the nth degree. It's clearly a great game. It's just not to my personal tastes, unfortunately.
For whatever this is worth, this is probably nearly peak Ratchet and Clank fatigue, I'd imagine. Like, this is where, like, this is like, what, the eighth or ninth entry in the series, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and the next two games clearly reflect that because they are not more of the same. They are something completely different, like almost unrecognizable. So you have All for One and Full Frontal Assault from 2011 and 2012.
I can't believe that they called the game Full Frontal Assault. Like, Full Frontal, yes. Funny. Full Frontal Assault, not funny. Horrible. Like, they're really unpleasant. In the UK, it's called Q-Force, and I'm not surprised. Because that's vile. Like, I mean, you know, all the other stuff is like, ha, underpants, going commando, ha, up your arsenal. And now it's Full Frontal Assault. That is not a pleasant image for anyone to experience. I don't think they should have called this game.
Really
that.
Hadn't thought about it that much.
I'm sorry. It's just, it's really unpleasant. I want to flag up that that was a misfire.
But, you know, it's described here as a DLC-heavy tower defense-ish game. With split screen. So to me, that's like bright colors on a poison lizard. Like the name is basically saying like, hey, this is bad. Avoid this. Mm. I could be wrong. Like maybe it's fun to play, but all of these points that are described here sound extremely unappealing to me.
Yeah, it's, I don't know if you've played Orcs Must Die, it's very much like that. In that you are a third person character running around a tower defense game, laying your turrets manually rather than clicking them like you would in something like, I don't know, Bloons or any other given tower defense game. And it is fun, especially in multiplayer, but the, and I hate to say it, but the hit to the frame rate makes it feel less polished than the previous games.
We knew we'd make a gamer out of you yet.
Yeah, well, when the thing is, when your whole series has been so smooth and so felt so good to play, when they suddenly halve it, it does kind of jar, especially since it's such a high AAA quality series before this. I think it was because it was also a Vita game. It's designed to fit onto that system as well, but it runs really poorly on the Vita, so... Yeah, I don't. It's okay. It's fine. There's a lot of like DLC minions and different things you can buy, which is that's kind of the era. You know, that's that era for you.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore. They don't do DLC anymore. It's finished.
Yeah, it's good. They finally moved away from that. Just package games, no add-on content. So there's also the top-down-ish multiplayer game All for One. This sounds like the description of it kind of sounds like those Tomb Raider or Hitman sort of spin-offs where it's like an isometric action game. Is that anything like what this is?
Well, Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light is great. It's really, really great. It's a really wonderful co-op puzzle game. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, Ratchet & Clank All for One is super boring and crappy.
Aha.
I could not get on with it at all. I couldn't even think what... The only thing I can think of to compare it to is Disney Universe, and no one's played Disney Universe. It's a bit like a Lego game, but not as good. You basically run around with only a few weapons, and there are four of you bashing crates and bashing enemies, but it does not have a Ratchet feel. It just is not that entertaining, unfortunately. It's not as good as Fuse, which is a very much hated game by Insomniac, which I loved. Play Fuse instead.
Bill, any thoughts on these, or did you skip them?
I skipped them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm happy to call Stuart the definitive voice on these games.
Awesome.
And then finally, one last game before we wrap up this episode, and that is 2013's Into the Nexus, which, you know, that is a 4-year gap from A Crack in Time. So finally, they really are kind of moving away from the annual approach and giving these games a little more time to bake. But I don't know really that much about Into the Nexus. This one totally flew past my radar. Just whoosh, no radar whatsoever. Oh, because it's a PS3 game released after the PS4 launch. That'll do it.
Yeah, I've only played the first couple of hours of this. It's the only one I've not actually finished, apart from the remake, which I will be resolving. The only reason I didn't finish it is because my PS3 died. But I don't really understand why they put it out in the state that it's in, because the half frame rate is the same as Q-Force. I refuse to call it its name. But it doesn't feel like a 30. It feels really flaky to me. It looks fantastic. It looks impressive as hell, even now, for a PS3 game. But the performance took a huge hit. This to me, a lot of people... We talk about something like Deadlocked being grimmer, but this felt like the grimmest one to me, because I'm pretty sure this game opens with a couple of your allies getting killed.
Yes.
And they've been around since Tools of Destruction, and it's not played for laughs or anything like that. It's quite serious. The villain in this game, from what I've seen of them, seems quite genuinely threatening compared to the other villains as well. There's a really interesting story going on, which one day I would love to finish, because... it seemed to play fine, just bad performance, and that was a bit of a bummer, but I'll finish it one day.
Yeah, you know, if you played a couple hours, you're basically halfway through the game, really.
okay.
I mean, it seems to have come at a strange point for Insomniac, because, you know, the PS4 was out. They were probably very deeply invested in Sunset Overdrive at the time, so I'm wondering how much people power they even had to put behind this game, really, And yeah, to Stuart's point, the frame rate is kind of a letdown, especially I'd come directly from A Crack in Time like a day ago, and I was like, oh, whoa, ooh. And the story is, like we were talking earlier about, there aren't really any, this is the closest they get to like taking a serious tone with the series, where it's like two characters do die in the first hour. The villains have kind of like a Burton-esque malevolence to them where they're like kind of creepy and like a little off kilter. And like the one segment is Ratchet like going through the orphanage where they used to live. And it's, you know, it's played pretty seriously. Like, you know, it kind of feels like they were thinking this might be the last one. Like, maybe I'm using too much hindsight bias there, but maybe. Like,
does it have a tone of sort of finality to it, of just kind of like,
so like with,
I don't know,
with the end of the game, if you don't mind me just going there.
Oh,
like,
not in the slightest. We're talking about Ratchet and Clank. I don't care.
It's like they pretty much, you know, close the book on, throughout the PS3 games, the story had been like Ratchet looking for the Lombaxes, and they're like, he's like, eh, I'm good. I don't need to look for them anymore. I'm going to, you know, hang around and hang out with Talwin. We're going to be buds. They don't go so far as say they'll be dating, but they're like, you know, and the gameplay itself is fine. Like, it's, you know, more Ratchet and Clank, although it's very abbreviated. Like, they also devote a decent amount of time to another Clank minigame, which is kind of interesting and has like a gravity inversion 2D side-scrolling platforming thing. It looks a lot like Inside. I don't know if there was the timing would match up for that, but it distinctly reminded me of like the stark black and white of Inside. Maybe Limbo. Maybe Limbo is more appropriate.
Yeah, so from that point, we go on to the remake, which we've already discussed, and then the upcoming Rift Apart. Oh, I got it right this time. And I didn't call it Jak and Daxter either. so that comes out as of this podcast, I think next week, or if you're listening to this on Patreon, in like a week and a half. So not too long at all. And we'll see, I guess, from there what happens with Ratchet and Clank. It kind of sounds like, you know, between the last two sort of core games before the remake, they were really sort of pushing this in a specific direction and trying to make it more like a, you know, to build the gravitas of the story and maybe make it a little more serious. So I'll be curious to see if they take that approach with Rifts Apart. Who knows when I will actually be able to play that, because I've had zero luck sourcing a PS5 to the point that I pretty much gave up. Like, when it turned out to be way easier for me to get a vaccine than a PS5, I feel like maybe something's a little screwed up here. But, you know, bless those of you who did manage to find one, and hopefully, you know, it will do well enough that the series will continue to have, you know, some staying power, some lasting power. And well, that's a good innuendo. It could be just called Ratchet and Clank Lasting Power. Because, you know, I do think it is a series with a nice legacy. Even though I'm not extremely experienced with the games, I have enjoyed what I've played of them, and I would like for the AAA space, as it were, to still have games that are fun and have personality and color and things like that. They don't all have to be, you know, gun sims. I mean, yeah, I guess there are guns in Ratchet and Clank, but it's not like murder guns. It's like goofy sci-fi, suck everyone into another dimension kind of guns. There's no like melee killing blows or anything like that. At least not that I'm aware of.
It's a pleasant other dimension. It's nice. They have a good time.
Very good.
Incidentally, I did manage to get a PS5, and if anyone would like to come over and look at it, it will cost you £15.
All right. I'll be over on the next boat. Anyway, I think that is it for this episode of Retronauts. We actually talked a lot more and a lot longer than I expected, which, you know, considering I have so little basis of knowledge for these games, I was a little worried, but nope. We definitely filled out some time. So that's what people are after, is just, you know, fill some time for us. And we did it. So I have to thank both of you, especially Bill, who requested this topic, and also Stuart, who has the seasoned wisdom of, you know, of experience to bring to this to this conversation. Both of you were the pillars of this episode and propped it up, even though it was crumbling all around me. So thank you both. Bill, again, thank you for supporting the show and for, you know, just continuing to patronize us, but not in like a patronizing way, in a patronage kind of way.
No, actually.
Right. Anyway, so that wraps it up for Retronauts. And, oh, okay, this episode of Retronauts, the show is not over. This is not the final episode. Just to be clear, Retronauts is not wrapped up.
Yeah, you can't end Retronauts before you do the James Pond episode.
That's Everyone true, that's that. True. That's what we're holding out for. It's like Arthur Dent. Okay, I'm not going to get into that.
Episode
anyway,
500, 24 hours of Millennium Software Vectordine mascot platformers.
Exactly. So Retronauts is not over, and you can continue enjoying the show in many places. Retronauts.com, on podcatchers such as Apple Music, not on Spotify because they're bad and we don't do them. But you can also listen to us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/retronauts, for $3 a month, you get every episode that we publish. No, sorry, every Monday episode that we publish. Every episode we publish on Mondays. There we go. You get that for $3 a month, a week in advance with a higher bitrate quality, no promotions or advertisements or anything like that. If you go an extra $2, you also get episodes every other Friday that are patron exclusive, as well as a patron exclusive column and mini podcast by Diamond Fight every single weekend. So that's you know, like more than doubling your value, honestly, for the extra $2. So anyway, that's my pitch. Patreon.com/retronauts. Gentlemen, share your pitches. Bill, I know you have a podcast.
I do, yes. It's called So Many Bits. It is on a bit of a hiatus, but there is an extensive archive of episodes featuring me interviewing different indie game devs about their work and their craft. I might be putting out one with a spoiler cast about a recent game with a lot of spoilers in it. So look for that coming up soon. I'm also on Twitch, twitch.tv/somanybits, typically Wednesday and Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Central Time if you want to stop by.
All right. And Stuart, you have more than one podcast.
I do. I have two podcasts. The number one podcast is Animania Chat, which is me and my dear friend Luke Fletcher reviewing every single episode of Animaniacs, which I hate. I hate Animaniacs. I hate that he's making me watch it. But we're up to episode 20 and we're never going to stop. This is my whole life now. I also do a podcast called Arseholevania, which is me and Andy Hamilton of various gaming outlets fame, where we come up with the worst take imaginable on a particular subject or video game, and then we tweet the take, and then we laugh at all the people who think that the take is real. It's essentially making the video games community worse, but in a fun way, I hope. And you can find those things by going to @stupacabra on Twitter and looking at the link tree that's there, because I don't want to read out the links.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter doing the GameSpite thing. That's my handle. You can find me on YouTube doing the Jeremy Parrish thing. That is also my handle there, Jeremy Parrish. And of course, doing Retronauts. Oh, also Limited Run Games. There's a bunch of fires and I've got irons in all of them. Just like video games, that's the stuff that I do. It's, yeah, there's a lot of it. So anyway, if you like video games and you like me, there's a lot of stuff about video games that you can enjoy on the internet, much of it for free. So thanks for listening. Thanks again, Bill, for sponsoring this episode. Thanks again, Stuart, for making this episode not a wasteland of my empty lack of knowledge. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening to this episode. We will be back in a week with another podcast because, as I said before, Retronauts is not over.
It will never end, ever.